the headlines this hour. The UN chief calls for more financial resources from donor countries to avert a looming humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. Iranian armed forces hold a major air defense drill in the central parts of the country. Also in the headlines, influential Iraqi cleric Muqtada al-Sadr pledges to fight corruption as initial results from Sunday's parliamentary elections show that his party is the biggest winner. Thanks for joining us. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for more financial resources from donor countries to avert a looming humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan.
We need to find ways to make the economy breathe again. And this can be done without violating international laws or compromising principles. We must seek ways to create the conditions that would allow Afghan professionals and civil servants to continue working to serve the Afghan population. I urge the world to take action and inject liquidity into the Afghan economy to avoid collapse. I think that's
Guterres explained that the Afghan economy is on the verge of collapse as the country's assets have been frozen and development aid to Kabul is on pause. The UN chief warned that such matters risk the closure of banks and the breakdown of the country's healthcare sector. He called the situation a very complex problem, criticizing the international community for a slow response. Guterres also noted that there is no way to heal the Central Asian country's economy unless women are allowed to work. Amin Alami says Afghan businessmen believe that the U.S. ban on their country's assets have directly affected the lives of ordinary people.
The people of Afghanistan are facing a rising economic crisis in this country. The assets of Afghanistan has been frozen by the United States there. In the meantime, Afghan businessmen and traders have blamed Washington for acting against the people of Afghanistan and acting against the Afghan traders and businessmen, because they say that at least 3 billion of those frozen assets belong to Afghan businessmen, not to the Afghan government. That is why they say that such act by Washington proves that this act by American officials will only serve the interests of the enemies of the people of Afghanistan, and it will not put pressure on the Taliban government here. That is why they all ask not only the United Nations and the United States of America, but all big international players to put pressure on the United States to release the frozen assets of Afghanistan.
On Friday, dozens of people were killed and scores more wounded in a bomb blast targeting a Shia mosque in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz. The Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility for the attack. Iranian officials were quick to condemn the attack, urging the Taliban to do what they can to establish peace and security in Afghanistan.
It was an attack that killed dozens. The death toll could be around 150. A bombing at a Shia mosque in Afghanistan's northeastern city of Kunduz during the Friday prayers. It was the worst attack since the Taliban took over control in August. All victims of the attack were Hazara Shias. Their community has been targeted by repression and violence in Afghanistan for decades now. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the suicide attack. Daesh has repeatedly targeted the Shia community across Afghanistan in the past. Experts believe this recent attack targeting the Kunduz mosque served several purposes for Daesh. One of their goals could be attempts to undermine the Taliban's newly established government. The other could be to continue their long-running murderous campaign aimed at ethnically cleansing the minority Hazara Shia community, who constitute roughly 15-20% of the country's population. The tragic incident drew condemnations from Iranian officials. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, condemned the attack, calling on Afghan officials to punish the perpetrators. Ayatollah Khamenei urged Afghan authorities to take measures to prevent such terrorist acts. Also, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi voiced concerns about the persistence of terrorist attacks in neighboring Afghanistan. He stated that the growth of the Daesh terror group has been a U.S. job and that Washington has supported this group in Afghanistan. Also, in a Sunday phone call with his French counterpart, Emmanuel Macron, Raisi said the world must hold the United States to account for supporting terrorism fomented by Daesh Takfir Group and other new forms of this ominous phenomenon. In addition, Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf condemned the attack, warning that the Afghan nation's enemies seek to stoke ethnic and religious discord in the country by using terrorists, who are backed by the United States. Also, Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, denounced the attack, saying Islamic nations and the international community have left the Afghan people alone. He called on Afghans to strengthen their national unity and solidarity and take steps to protect civilians from Daesh terrorists.
We know it's very clear that Daesh is supported by the U.S. and the Zionists. We've seen how they tried to disrupt Iraq and Syria and try to cause a major stabilization in these two countries. Luckily, there was strong resistance and unified resistance and a unified force to defeat Daesh and destroy them fully and eradicate them from the area.
The Iranian Army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps have launched joint air defense drills in the center of the country. The drills feature homemade missile, radar, reconnaissance, and electronic warfare, as well as communications systems. Phase one of the maneuvers is conducted with the participation of rapid reaction forces. It features passive defense operations to deceive the enemy. Reconnaissance flights are also carried out with manned and unmanned aircraft. Troops also conduct tactical and defense operations using detection and combat systems against hostile aircraft. Iran says the drills aim to boost air protection and defend its key centers. Iran's foreign minister says all Muslim countries should assume greater responsibility when it comes to the Palestinian issue and the situation in Al-Quds. Hossein Amir Abdullahian also called for greater concerted action by international bodies to help Palestine. He was speaking on the phone with his Jordanian counterpart, whose country holds the custodianship of the holy sites in Al-Quds. The top Iranian diplomat rejected any initiative that denies Palestinians their right and perpetuates the Israeli occupation. He said the only way to resolve the Palestinian issue is a referendum involving original residents from all faiths. Amir Abdullahian also called for boosting ties between Iran and Jordan. Ayman Safadi said that relations with Iran are significant for Jordan. He also underlined the need for the protection of Palestinians' rights. Iraq's prominent cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has vowed to fight corruption, as initial results from last week's parliamentary elections puts his political bloc in the lead.
We won't allow parties to take control of public money and resources. They are for the people. Every corrupt person will be held accountable, whoever they are.
Saad said that his movement will work to protect and secure Iraq. His supporters hit the streets in the capital, Baghdad, to celebrate their victory. Initial results showed that the Sadrist bloc has won 73 seats and is leading in several provinces, including Baghdad. The Progress bloc, with 38 seats, is in second place. Former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's party comes third with 37 seats. People chose members of the 329-seat legislature on Sunday. More than 25 million were eligible to cast their ballots. Iraq's Electoral Commission has put the turnout at 41%. That is lower than the last general election held in 2018. North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un says that the U.S. is, quote, the root cause of instability on the Korean Peninsula. Kim, during a defense exhibition, said that there is no basis to believe that Washington is not hostile toward Pyongyang, despite its denials. He also accused South Korea of seeking to destroy balance on the peninsula with its military developments. The North Korean leader said that his country's weapons programs are in self-defense in the face of hostile U.S. policies and a military buildup in the south. He said, however, that Pyongyang will not start a war in the region. Kim has long accused Washington and Seoul of pursuing a hostile policy. Tensions have escalated since the two neighbors conducted missile tests in recent weeks. Lawrence Davison, a former lecturer with the Westchester University, says that American leaders can hardly make a decision on leaving the Korean Peninsula, as it might prove a political suicide for them.
Now, the Americans have a long history on the peninsula, and that history really flows from an anti-communist kind of crusade that the U.S. entertained after World War II. To a certain extent, that crusade still goes on, even though, you know, the Russians are not called the USSR anymore. But, I mean, the Chinese are right across the Yalu River, and so, you know, China is a potential enemy for the U.S. And so, you know, that kind of what was anti-communism and now just identifying competitors and enemies, that persists. Also, there's a certain amount of face, I guess you would call it, involved in this. I mean, what does Kim want the Americans to do? Pack up and leave. All right, but I mean, that's political suicide for the American, whatever American leader does that.
Chinese officials say last week's floods in Shanxi province have killed at least 15 people. The officials say that three people are still unaccounted for. They say that the flooding triggered by torrential rains disrupted the lives of nearly 2 million residents. Tens of thousands of buildings were destroyed or seriously damaged. Shanxi province in North China is normally a dry region, but it received 3 months' rain in almost a week. Several other regions across China were also hit by unprecedented rain and flooding this year. One of the worst hit areas was the central province of Henan, where more than 300 people were killed in July. Experts blame the situation on climate change. Let's go back to the story about the drills conducted by the IRGC. Yusuf Jalali is a correspondent joining us from Semnan to tell us more about that. Yusuf, what do you have for us?
Well, Kaveh, the drills are held jointly by the Iranian IRGC and the Iranian Air Defense and Air Force in a sprawling desert stretching for some half a million square kilometers in central Iran. So this is one of the most significant drills, given the fact that it is held this time jointly by the IRGC and the Iranian army. And this is a message as put by the Iranian military officials that Iran is always ready, and different units of the Iranian armed forces are, of course, they have full synergy and coordination to counter any potential threat. The drills are routine drills, of course, held every year as a means to bolster coordination, as I mentioned, and also to put to test the latest domestically built weapons and arms developed by the Iranian experts, as Iran is under four decades of U.S.-led arms embargoes. The sanctions started as early as four decades ago when Iran entered a full-scale war with Iraq. It was an Iraqi-imposed war against the Islamic Republic of Iran, which took 8 years to finish, of course, that war. And during that war, Iran suffered the U.S.-led sanctions, and Iraq had the full support of Western countries. That triggered Iran's quest for self-sufficiency in the defense sector. And right now, Iran boasts its self-sufficiency in the defense sector. Iran says that it is Iran says that it is now producing 80% of its needed weaponry inside the country using its domestic know-how. And these drills are a chance and an opportunity for the Iranian armed forces to test those latest military equipment and also to showcase them to the West and to its enemies that Iran is capable of defending its own borders using its own domestically built arms and military hardware. Now, we see that during this drill, a wide range of drones, helicopters, missile systems, and also missiles, cruise missiles, were put on display and used during this drill. So the drill is a two-day maneuver starting early today and continuing until tomorrow. And the drill, as I said, is held, of course, jointly by the Iranian army and the IRGC. And given the recent developments in Iran's eastern borders and northwestern borders, we have on the Iranian eastern borders the recent developments in Afghanistan and the Taliban takeover of power, which sparked fears inside the country that that insecurity and the developments might cause some problems for Iran. Those developments might pose some threats to Iran. That is on the Iranian eastern borders. And on the Iranian northwestern borders, we see that the recent war of words between Azerbaijan and the Islamic Republic of Iran, following Azerbaijan's move, which, of course, imposed road taxes on Iranian trucks passing through Azerbaijan and bound for Armenia, carrying fuel to Armenia. With that led to Iran starting a massive drill, another drill on its northwestern borders with Azerbaijan that was conducted by the Iranian army's ground force. And now this one is also a message for Iran's neighbors and for the Iranian enemies, as spoke by the Iranian military officials, that Iran is always ready to counter any threat posed by any potential enemy.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it, Yusuf Jalali there from Semnan. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're going to continue our discussion of Imam Khomeini's views on different issues. In today's program, you'll be listening to his advice on the authorities and students of seminaries. Please stay with us.
¶¶
Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, had explicated his views on seminaries and presented necessary warnings on the issue during his lifetime. However, this issue is the most important message to the seminaries and to religious scholars of ulama in the waning months of the Imam's life. In his message, the Imam called the ulama or religious scholars as the carriers and trustees of revelation, which they should strive to guide the people through the content of revelation and what has been bequeathed to us from the Prophet of Islam and his infallible progeny, blessings of God upon them. He writes in his message, "There is no doubt that the seminaries and the committed ulama throughout the history of Islam and Shi'ism have been the most important bastion of Islam against assaults and deviations. The great religious scholars or ulama of Islam have tried through their lifetimes to promote the issues of divine haram or forbidden laws and halal or permitted laws without modification. Had there not been the dear jurisprudence, it was not clear what sciences would have been sold to the masses in the name of sciences of the Quran, Islam, and Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. The collection and preservation of the sciences of the Holy Quran and Islam, and the works and hadiths of the great Prophet, and the practices and behavior of the infallible Imams, peace be upon them, and the registration, compilation, and explication of them under the conditions that there were very little facilities and the rulers and oppressors had employed all their facilities to destroy the works of prophethood was not an easy job. Yet, thank God, today we can see the result of those efforts in the works and books such as Kutub-e Arba'e, the four main books of Shia seminaries, and other books of the previous and future generations in the fields of jurisprudence, philosophy, mathematics, astronomy, principles of jurisprudence, hadith, history of Islam, exegesis of the Holy Quran, literature, Irfan or Gnosticism, lexicon, and all various fields of sciences. If we do not call this much effort as jihad in the way of God, then what shall we call it?" Imam Khomeini continues in his message for ulama and the seminaries. "As for the scientific services of seminaries, there is too much to say to the extent that it goes beyond the scope of what can be mentioned here. Thank God the seminaries are rich and innovative from the viewpoint of sources and methods of discussion and ijtihad or independent reasoning on the basis of the Holy Quran and Hadith. I do not think that there can be found a more proper way for deep and comprehensive examination of Islamic sciences than the methods of the preceding ulama. Over 1,000 years of history of research and erudition of true ulama or religious scholars of Islam bears testimony to this claim. This has nurtured the sapling of Islam to flourish. For hundreds of years, the clergy of Islam have been the support of the deprived. The downtrodden have always been satiated by the pure kosar of the teachings of great jurisprudence. Apart from their scientific and cultural struggles, which are superior to the bloods of martyrs in some aspects, in every age, they have suffered hardships and bitterness in defense of their religion and patriotic sanctities. And while suffering captivity, exile, prison, imprisonment, harassment, and taunts, they have offered precious martyrs to the divine court. The martyrs of the clergy are not restricted to the martyrs of struggles and the war in Iran. Certainly, the number of anonymous martyrs of seminaries and the clergy who have lost their lives in the path of spreading the divine teachings and divine laws in the hands of mercenaries is very large. In every divine and popular uprising and revolution, the ulama or religious scholars of Islam have been the first who have been martyred." late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, continued by saying, "This does not mean that we defend all clergymen, and the dependent and sanctimonious clergy were not and are not small in number. There are people in seminaries who are active against pure Muhammadian Islam. Today, some people, through sanctimonious posture, are cutting the roots of religion, revolution, and the system in a way as if they had no other duty. The danger of this backwardness and regression is certainly not small. Dear students, should not neglect these colorful snakes for a single moment. These are the promoters of American Islam and the enemies of God's messengers." The late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, points to two key methods that are used by enemies in seminaries. The Imam said, "Once the global arrogance was disappointed at complete destruction of the clergy and seminaries, it chose two ways to strike. One was intimidation and coercion, and the other way was deception and infiltration in the contemporary decades. When the weapon of intimidation and threatening was useless, the way of infiltration was strengthened. The first and most important move was the insinuation of the slogan of separation of religion from politics, which has unfortunately worked to some extent in seminaries and among the clergy so that interference in politics is considered as inferior to the status of the jurisprudent, and entering the arena of politics will cause the accusation of dependence on foreigners. For sure, the struggling clergy have been suffering more from infiltration. Do not think that the accusation of dependence and calumny of irreligiousness have been applied against the clergy only by foreigners. This is not so. The blows of unaware and dependent, aware clergy have been much stronger than those of the foreigners." Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, also addressed the clergy in his testimony. The Imam said, "I recommend to the seminaries, as I have repeatedly said, that in this era that the opponents of Islam and the Islamic Republic have attempted to topple Islam and try in every way to achieve this satanic goal, one of the important ways to this unholy and dangerous end is to infiltrate deviated and wicked persons in seminaries, whose great short-term danger is to scandalize the seminaries with indecent acts and deviated ethics and methods. And the very danger in long-term is to attain high positions by one or a few charlatans who ensconce themselves among the masses and strata of pure-hearted people and make them love them and then deal a fatal blow to the Islamic seminaries and dear Islam and the country at the right moment." Dear listeners, in our next program, we shall continue our discussions today. Until then, goodbye and God bless.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, millions of British people could fall into fuel poverty this year. That means that some would have to cut back on the basics in order to be able to heat their homes. This gas shortage and price rise follow empty pumps at petrol stations, where due to a shortage of truck drivers, Brits have had to wait in long lines to fill up their cars. Even the government has brought the army in to drive trucks to try to fill the supply gap. But all of it seems to be pointing to mismanagement by the government. Stay with us as we take a look at it all on this Spotlight. Let's cross over to London, start off with Amina Taylor. Amina, give us your take. What's going on?
Yeah, this is shaping up to what some commentators are saying is a return to the bad old days. The old phrase, winter of discontent, being thrown around here, because not only did you have those rather unsavory scenes of empty fuel pumps and consumers queuing up to get a little bit of petrol for their cars if there was any to go around, you're also combating and trying to balance that with issues in the breakdown of the fuel supply train. You're also looking at a situation where energy firms, some of the smaller ones who are able to perform and provide a little bit more competition in the market, going bust. So on one hand, you have fuel issues at the pumps, and at the other hand, you're looking at fuel issues for the homes. And as always, you have the most vulnerable consumers having to deal with some very real crisis-making decisions about whether or not they can put food in their bellies, food in the bellies of their children, or perhaps provide fuel for their vehicles to get to work, to get to some crucial jobs, or to heat their homes. So I think many of those who would have listened to the Prime Minister's speech a little bit earlier in the week will be wondering what parallel universe Boris Johnson is living in, when so many of his subjects will be wondering just how they will make it through the winter this month. And unfortunately, I believe this is just the beginning of things to come, and unfortunately not the beginning of the end.
Well, I mean, just staying with you briefly, because the Prime Minister has tried to show a brave face and said that things are getting better. I mean, your assessment of people's reaction on the ground, I mean, do they believe this? Do they believe that things are getting better, or are they feel that it's getting worse?
Well, they don't have to believe if it's getting better or worse. They just have to look at the realities on the ground. And even though one might think that the Conservatives would be a bit further behind in the poll, they're not, which tells its own story. But it's also about when this starts to bite a little bit more, because even if individuals didn't have the major issues with their vehicles, maybe these individuals will not be affected by the rise in domestic fuel prices just yet for their homes. When some of these price caps go and people are renegotiating the cost of energy to their homes, they'll really start to feel that bump. And we're talking about hundreds of pounds for even the most conservative estimate here. So unfortunately, it's not a matter of whether they have an impression of what's going on. The reality will soon come to bite, unfortunately. And it's those lower to middle income families that will feel it the most. £400 is nothing to somebody who's earning a lot of money. But believe me, when you're already counting every penny, this is just enough to push you over the edge.
Thank you so much, Amina Taylor, correspondent in London, for that report. I'd like to welcome out of London now author and historian Marcus Papadopoulos. And out of Edinburgh, writer and political analyst John White.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us to start this off. With Marcus out of London. I mean, Marcus, the government says the fuel crisis happened because there were not enough drivers to supply the service stations. But did the government not calculate this ahead of time? I mean, why was the situation allowed to reach such a critical point?
Well, I should first of all start by saying that, currently speaking, there is no energy crisis in the UK. Further to that, there is no food crisis either. Recently, I travelled from London to Pembrokeshire, stopping off at numerous places along the way. I saw no signs of an energy crisis. I saw no signs of food shortages in any of the supermarkets which I visited. It is certainly the case that a couple of weeks or so ago, people were stockpiling petrol or diesel, and that did cause a short-term problem. But the people who were stockpiling petrol or diesel did so on account of mainstream media outlets in the UK putting out completely uncorroborated, unsubstantiated stories saying that there will be a petrol crisis in Britain. I would also add as well that it is certainly the case that many of these aspects have been mismanaged by the current government. But then this is a problem that has been plaguing Britain for many years now. So we hear about how there will be in Britain this winter a rise in electricity and a rise in gas. But year in, year out, there is always a rise in energy prices in Britain.
So Marcus, are you saying this has been created? I'm sorry to interrupt you. So are you saying that this has been created by the media? And if so, why?
What I believe is that British mainstream media is depicting something in order to distract the British public from a lot of very serious problems at home. It is certainly the case that the British government has relied too extensively on liquefied natural gas. Also, the British government should have put politics aside and should have sat down with the Russian government and secured an energy deal with Russia, which would have resulted with an uninterrupted flow of Russian natural gas. But alas, the British wanted to put politics first, and as a result, if there is to be a shortage of gas this winter in Britain, that will be the fault of the British state, and the ordinary British man and woman will pay the price. And it goes back to what I said moments ago. There is always a rise in the UK every single year in the price of gas and electricity. Why? Because energy was privatised many years ago in Britain. Why is it that people in Russia do not struggle to pay their gas bills or their electricity bills? Why? Because electricity and gas has been state-run. It is not, electricity and gas does not exist in Russia to make a profit. It exists to provide people with electricity and gas. The same cannot be said, alas, in Britain.
Right,
electricity and gas is used by the British state to make money. Like public services in Britain are used by the public state to make money.
All right, stay with me. I mean, because I think we're going to get into the whole, then we look at neoliberalism and what has happened in the West because of those policies. So let me get John in on this conversation. John, your take, you heard what Marcus said, that basically this has been something that has been exaggerated because basically there really isn't a crisis. What do you think?
There is a crisis. It's a global crisis. Excuse me, I'll just change position. The light's in the way here. It's a global crisis caused in large part by the surge in demand for fuel post-COVID by economies all over the world. But Brexit has exacerbated that crisis due to the supply chain issues created by Brexit. The just-in-time supply chain system adopted by the UK has broken down because the importation of vital supplies and basic necessities have been interrupted by increased custom controls and bureaucracy. So there is a multiplicity of crises, and the UK has been in the eye of a storm because of COVID, but also because of Brexit and all the problems that it has unleashed.
Okay, and to our viewers, hopefully we will establish that video connection right now. That was, of course, the voice that you could hear of John. Hopefully we'll establish a better connection. I mean, Marcus, you say that basically you had driven through the country and you went to various stores and you did not notice it. So tell me about when we have been seeing long lines at petrol stations. We have been shown shelves that have been half empty, and we've had people actually had interviews in the UK with individuals on the street that are complaining about the current situation. I mean, what do you say to this? Hasn't the country gone from crisis to crisis, or do you not see it that way?
Well, I must first of all clarify something. There is no global energy crisis. Such an argument is completely untenable. For example, there is no energy crisis in France. There is no energy crisis in Germany. There is no energy crisis in Italy. Indeed, there is no energy crisis anywhere in Europe. Why? Because Europe or the European Union and also individual countries which make up Europe have secured concrete agreements with Russia to receive an uninterrupted flow of gas. Those governments put their people first by wanting to ensure that their industries and domestic households would not be left without electricity or gas at any time of the year. Now, returning to the UK, yes, it is certainly the case that for a few days there was a shortage, and I have to use the word shortage in a very loose way, a shortage of petrol and diesel, not because there was a lack of petrol or diesel in the UK. It was because British mainstream media was putting out stories, as I said moments ago, completely unsubstantiated stories, which caused panic. And as a result, people were stockpiling petrol and diesel. People were going to their local petrol stations. They were taking jerry cans with them. They were filling them up. And that was causing a short-term problem. But that only lasted for a few days. Furthermore, it is the case that in some areas of the UK, supermarkets were not bare, they were not empty, but there were certainly products which were not available. But that was only a few cases. However, British mainstream media has depicted a completely false picture by saying that the whole of the UK is experiencing a shortage of energy and a shortage of food. That is simply not the case. And I believe that part of the reason for this false portrayal is to distract the British people from some very worrying developments at home. And I'm specifically referring to these changes which the British state is imposing on the British people vis-a-vis what is known as COVID-19. But there are also many other problems in Britain. For example, there are 14 million people in Britain living in poverty. That includes 4 million children. 4 million children living below the breadline. Now, one of the tactics the British state has used over centuries to remain entrenched in power is to distract the average British man and woman from what is happening in their society.
Okay.
So, for instance, they will say that Russia is causing the energy crisis. They will say that Russia is a threat to the freedom and democracy of Britain, because they are distracting the British people from the terrible measures and the terrible problems which are plaguing the British people.
Okay, stay with me, Marcus. Let me get John back in on this. John, your take. You were shaking your head partially while Marcus was speaking. Your take on this. So go ahead.
This is not a crisis that's being fabricated by the British mainstream media. There is a material crisis. It's largely a result of the post-COVID demand for energy around the world, especially on the part of the Chinese and Indian economies. European countries are suffering fuel shortages, but not to the same extent as UK because of Brexit, and also because they have larger and better storage facilities. For example, under the May government, the largest storage facility in the UK that could hold the gas reserves and fuel reserves for up to 3 months was shut down by Centrica, and now we only have the capacity to store fuel for 3 days. So that's had a material effect on the crisis. Gazprom is refusing to, or certainly up to now, has refused to go beyond the contract that agreed with the UK and other European territories for its supply. Putin recently voiced his opinion on the matter, saying that he will not let this crisis go to a certain point. He will look to increase production under Gazprom, which is a Russian state-owned energy giant. But there is a crisis globally because of the demand. COVID has accentuated that crisis. We have a crisis of haulage because of the shortage of HGV drivers, which is also part of the crisis because European drivers can't get into the UK as easily as they did under the EU. Northern Ireland is not suffering the same crisis because it still operates under the single market as part of the Northern Ireland Protocol. So I do respectfully have to disagree with the thrust on Marcus's points on this matter.
Well, John, you feel that what you're calling these various crises, that it has been exacerbated by Brexit? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. We have different customs arrangements with the EU. We're not part of the single market. We do no longer have frictionless trade. Boris Johnson lied when he said that his deal, his oven-ready deal, would still maintain frictionless trade. And so it's caused interruption in supply chains, and that has fed into a crisis. So as I said, there's a multiplicity of factors involved, but the issue is that Brexit has only sown dragon's teeth. Rather than free us from the clutches of the dictatorship in Brussels, as its main drivers would have maintained, Nigel Farage and the right wing of the Tory party, it has only made Britain isolated. And it just confirms that Brexit is an entirely misplaced understanding of Britain's role in the world in the second decade of the 21st century. It is an emotional reach back in time to a supposed golden age when Britannia ruled the waves and the Union Jack flew wherever it damn well pleased. And guess what? You can't eat a flag. A flag doesn't eat a hole. It doesn't put food on the table. And this is a result of false consciousness.
Marcus, your thoughts on that? I mean, do you feel that the Brexit has played a role in all of this? Or do you feel that all of this is part of what you said, basically just trying to deflect some other problems, more serious problems that are taking place there?
Well, as I said moments ago, Britain has relied on liquefied natural gas, and Britain should have looked to Germany as an example of ensuring gas, an uninterrupted flow of gas for British industry and households by securing an agreement with Russia. And in the last few days, we have seen a most bizarre chapter with British mainstream media. Because first of all, British mainstream media outlets were running stories saying that Vladimir Putin wanted to increase the supply of natural gas to Europe to avert a crisis. Then within 48 hours or so, the same media outlets were saying that Vladimir Putin is going to decrease the amount of natural gas to Europe to instigate a crisis. It really is preposterous nonsense. I also do not believe any role in this. I believe that whilst I support Britain withdrawing from the European Union, the European Union is not a socialist entity. It is a neoliberal, culture-hating, religion-hating. It's inflicted horrific damage on the lives of working-class people across the European Union. One need only visit countries in Central Europe, such as Hungary and the Czech Republic, and in Eastern Europe, such as Romania and Poland, to see how factories have been as a result of the European Union. But it is most certainly the case, and I've been saying this for many years, that Britain is a country plagued by many illnesses. And this has been the case for centuries. Why? because the British state, different to the lives of the ordinary British man and woman, wherever they are in the Union, in England, in Scotland, in Wales, in Northern Ireland, they simply do not care. And when I say the British state, I mean the British establishment, for example, the royal family and the aristocracy. For instance, energy should not have been privatised. Electricity and gas should exist to ensure that people do not go cold in the autumn and winter months. Electricity should exist to provide people with lighting at any time of the year. But because the British state values money above all else, it privatised energy. And it is absolutely true that for decades now, not just since Brexit, for decades now, British people in the autumn and winter months have been fearful of putting on the heating because they are afraid they will not be able to pay their energy bills.
All right, let me get John in here because our time is running out quickly. But John, how is it that London still considers itself as Great Britain when it appears that it is getting more and more difficult for it to even keep millions of its people from simply freezing to death? I mean, it really does not sound like a first world country. Your thoughts?
Well, the British political establishment no longer runs an empire, but does operate under the illusions of an empire mind, and this is fed into Brexit. It has also managed to persuade a large swathe of working class people that the Union Jack is the way forward rather than class-based politics, which Marcus has eloquently laid out. I do entirely agree with the large part of the problem is not supply, it's ownership. Energy should be under state control. It's a necessity, it's a basic necessity. Privatisation has been an unmitigated disaster. But the entire Western world is going through the same crisis of late capitalism. But the British state's answer to that crisis, which 2008 global economic crash, has been to withdraw from the world, withdraw from reality, and lose itself in illusions of grandeur based on a misplaced understanding of the British Empire, a failure to address the real history of that empire. So this is a problem of a lack of understanding of Britain's role in the world, a lack of understanding of the empire, or the British obscurantism fed by myths surrounding the Second World War and Britain's role in the Second World War, and the demonization of Russia.
Okay.
Russia is the biggest country in Europe, and the idea that you can isolate Russia, that you can have a Europe that's going to be stable without Russia being included as a major partner.
And on that note, I'm so sorry I have to interrupt. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me on the Spotlight. Marcus Papadopoulos, author and historian out of London. John White, writer and political analyst out of Edinburgh. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Razia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, and I'm your host, Musa al-Bahadili. Joining me in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you, and assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi
wabarakatuh. Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Our question today is as follows. The God of the Muslims, he orders the Muslims to وَقْتَلُوهُمْ حَيْثُ ثَقِفْتُمُوهُمْ, meaning, and kill them wherever you find them, as written in the chapter Al-Baqarah of the Quran. Therefore, Islam and the Islamic God, he orders Muslims to murder. What do we say to this accusation, dear Sheikh?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Again, this is another question and another misconception which is rooted in taking the verse out of context and taking into consideration few words of the Quran and ignoring other related verses and even the verses before and after this part of the Quran. Yes, Allah says that وَاقْتُلُوكُمْ حَيْثُ ثَقِفْتُمُوكُمْ, and some people come to claim that so Muslims are allowed to kill non-Muslims whenever they find them because God says kill them.
Seemingly, yeah.
Yeah, seemingly. So first of all, we need to, as a kind of introduction, there is a kind of, we know that we have two types of jihad, fighting for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The one is called the initiative war, or al-jihadul ibtida'i, that is the, for example, Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, he starts the war. And the other one is the defensive war.
Right.
Non-Muslims attacks Muslims and they just defend themselves. Now, all Muslims, they agree that initiative jihad is permitted at the time of the presence of the Prophet or an infallible Imam. But whether it happened in practice or not, it's a matter of discussion. Nowadays, many scholars believe that at the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, all the wars of the Prophet were defensive.
Right.
And one of the reasons that some people call them initiative war is the fact that they do not pay attention to what led the Prophet to come to fight, for example, the Jews or the Christians or the polities.
The circumstances.
Yeah. So, for example, when it comes to the Battle of Badr, it's not an initiative jihad at all. The properties of Muslims were confiscated by the pagans,
right,
in Mecca. And the Prophet came to know that a caravan by Quraysh is passing by near the city of Medina. So he tried to, go to that caravan and just take some of the properties in exchange of those properties confiscated by the same people.
Right.
And then the Quraysh, they came to know about this plan and they sent an army and they began the war. And the same is true about, according to many scholars nowadays, true about all other battles at the time of the Prophet. He never began a war. Imam Hajj al-Salam, even in all his three battles, he told his companions that you have no right to begin the war. He tried his best to convince some of the people to, abandon fighting Imam Ali alayhi salam. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on Layl Ashura, although he was, besieged by so many, a great number of the enemies, again, he did not begin the war. He waited for the enemy to start the war. And
it was a defensive war.
Yeah. So the point is that when we research the history of Islam, we see that at the time of all the infallibles, none of them they have began a war. All of them they have been in the form of this defensive war. So now let's talk about these three verses.